Welcome. This is the final night in our series in Genesis 1 to 12. We're taking a break then and starting again in mid-May on the book of Romans. We're only covering the first half of the book of Romans next term, and then we'll do the other half of the book of Romans from 9 to 16 later. It's a book that is foundational for how the gospel brings God's salvation to the world. And some of the key words are words like faith and righteousness or justification. I'm hoping to start by asking the question, who were the Romans? And why was this written to them? So that we can understand their situation and then understand what was being said to them. It's surprising how much we can know about them. What we are talking about is the first 12 chapters of Genesis. We saw how God cleansed a world that had been corrupted by violence. And then after the flood, God replanted the world and gave authority to Noah. And Noah used that authority to declare slavery for the world. As soon as God gave humans this authority, it turns out that we can't use it. It seems like God's the only one who can actually handle authority well. But because God had given authority, that was chapter 9. In chapter 10, the nations were able to set up governments and leadership of their own, not under God's leadership. And from the Jewish perspective, that's really important because the rest of the Old Testament, Israel is God's nation and these other nations ought to be under God's management. That's the whole point of Genesis 1 to 11. But they're not. They refuse God's leadership. So the gospel has to bring the nations back under God's Messiah before the story can be complete. And then we're moving on tonight to chapter 11, where one of these nations is banding together to build kingdoms. Remember we saw that last week too? There was a guy who wanted to create war. He used death, the power of death that God had given to the community in chapter 9. He wants to use that to fight wars, to build kingdoms, is Genesis 10 and 11. And so you have kingdoms that are starting to be built, and they're named as Assyria and Babylon, the big kingdoms that came later. The foundation for that was laid by the nations trying to war against each other to build kingdoms. And Babylon was the kingdom that ultimately destroyed the nation of Israel as a nation. And from the time that Babylon invaded Jerusalem and wiped the place out, they were under foreign rule right through to the time of Jesus, when they were still under foreign rule in Rome. So this Babylon has already raised its head in Genesis 10 as a kingdom that's taking over the other nations by war. And then in chapter 11, we have the account of the Tower of Babel. That's the way it's headed up in most of our Bibles. I just want you to know that the Hebrew word Babel is the same word as Babylon. Everywhere else in Old Testament text, Babel is translated as Babylon, except in Genesis. I don't know why they made this differently. Maybe because everybody's heard of the Tower of Babel. But actually, Babel wasn't a tower, it was a city. Babylon wasn't a tower, it was a city. So the city of Babylon is what's being described here rather than the Tower of Babel. And the city had a tower, or the city constructed a tower. Let us build ourselves a city, is the message that the people have. And that's what we're going to be looking at tonight, this kingdom of Babylon, the city of Babylon that was the headquarters for the entire kingdom that was trying to take over God's world. So that's what we're talking about in this hour. And then after the break, we're going to be talking about God calling Abraham. So you're familiar with the story of the Tower of Babel? Let's read it and see if we can make sense of it as a city. This time, the whole world had one language and a common speech. And as people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. This is the area that Abraham came from. It was, in ancient times, it was called Shinar. It was also called Chaldea, Ur of the Chaldees. It was like the center of where they had many, many names. And eventually, it came to be called Babylon after the region had been controlled by Assyria to the north. So they settled in the plain of Shinar, and they said to each other, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. And they used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Now, when you see something in the text like this, I've got a curiosity. Many of you have too. We've had so many good questions over the last few weeks, and I love the opportunity to dive in and look at some of those questions. But here, the question I have is, why do I need to know what was significant about them using bricks instead of stone? Now, the text doesn't tell us why. So I probably should say what I've said again and again over the last few weeks. I don't know. But I'd like to hazard a little guess and take it or leave it. Bricks are man-made. And to the people who were putting this text together, it would have been much easier if they'd used stones. If you went down to Egypt, what was Pharaoh building with? He was building with stone. Like, the pyramids are not made by individual bricks. Why would you go to all the trouble of forming all those little individual bricks and baking them and all the energy and the time and the effort that it takes to make a man-made thing instead of the stones that the gods gave us? Architectural buildings make a statement. And this statement was all about the power of man rather than the power of God. So I think baking bricks was an architectural statement about human power, because Babylon wanted to be the seat of human power over the whole world. And my guess is that's why that detail is included in the text. But what they're doing is building themselves a city. Now, a city is a large area, lots of people moving in, and it's an administrative center. So Perth is kind of like the administrative center for the state, and Canberra is the administrative center for Australia. So a city is kind of like the administrative center for a kingdom. Babylon, the city, was the administrative center for the kingdom of Babylon. So what they're building is a city under human power, a city designed to honour human power rather than to recognise God's authority, God's power. We've kind of seen that already with Cain. Remember, Cain went and built a city and named it after his son. It was in honour of the human rather than God. Seems to me that's what's going on with. They're trying to build themselves a city that will represent God's authority. And as they build this city, they want to put up a symbol that tells everybody, we have climbed up into the heavens and we have taken the power of the gods and we have brought it down into human hands. Because other nations also understood that the gods were ruling the world. They thought there was different gods in different places, but they had that concept. So what they were doing then was climbing up and grasping the power of the gods and taking that into human hands, so that they themselves were the people who were running the entire world. Essentially, what they want to do is to take over God's world and have control of God's world in human hands. They said, we want to make a name for ourselves because we are the people who are running the world. There's a contrast between that and what happens later in Scripture. It's interesting that right through Scripture, you've got this contrast between Babylon, the city devoted to human power, and Jerusalem, the city devoted to God's power. Jerusalem, according to the Psalms, was the place that lived for the honour of God's name, whereas Babylon is the city that lives for the honour of their own name. I think that's the contrast that's being made in verse 4. The other purpose for the city is so that it will not be scattered all over the earth. Now, in chapter 10, we saw the nations spreading out and scattering all over the earth. So that's kind of already happened. What do they mean, so we won't be scattered over the face of the earth? What they mean is we won't be all separate nations scattered everywhere. We'll be one central government to rule the world. We will rule God's world. We will take over God's world. We will control everything. Now, the Jewish people fell foul of Babylon, as the story of the Old Testament continues. The last chapter of 2 Kings describes Jerusalem falling to Babylon, and the city that was supposed to be devoted to God was now under the control of Babylon instead, because Babylon wants to control the whole earth. So Babylon is actually a threat to God's plan to save the world. God planned to save the world through the family of Abraham, through the Jewish people, ultimately through the Messiah who came from Israel. But if Israel gets wiped out, and if they're not a people of God anymore, and the whole world is under foreign control and there is no people of God anymore, then Babylon has wrecked the salvation story, overturned the whole thing by taking God's nation, God's people, God's kingdom, and making it part of a kingdom that's devoted to human power instead of divine power. So when they talk about people not being scattered all over the earth, it's about having everything under their own control. Is this making sense? Do you want to talk back about that? Make sense of Babylon? Great. So, what does God do? Interestingly, in chapter 10, when the nations went their own way and spread it everywhere, God didn't stop them. God had given the power of life and death into human hands in chapter 9, so they could now, as communities, set up leaders and run without God if they chose to do that, and God let them do it. So Nimrod was getting up God's nose, I think is probably the best way to understand him, as a hunter before the face of God, defiance against God, and God let them get away with it. Is God going to allow Babylon to take his entire world from him? Will God do that? And of course, that is the question the Jewish people are asking after the exile. Are we the ex-people of God? I don't know if you've ever read the book of Lamentations. There's five chapters. And the closing verses of Lamentations say, effectively, are we the ex-people of God? We're sure that God is faithful to the covenant, but are we so unfaithful that God's given up on us? Is it all over, as far as we're concerned? Is the salvation plan of God finished? They don't use those words, but that's the question that they're asking once they fall to Babylon. Is God going to let Babylon take over everything? And I'm sure some of them are asking the question, why didn't God stop this before it began? Why did God stop it in the early days when nations and kingdoms started forming? Why does God allow this in the world? So that's the essence of the question that's being raised here in this chapter. And the chapter has an answer to that question. God is not going to allow human leaders to take over his world. God acts, but God doesn't act the way human leaders do, and he doesn't act the way that we might expect. If Babylon had a huge army and it was coming down against Jerusalem, I don't know if you can picture the battle, the clash, the soldiers. You can see people up on the walls of Jerusalem, bows and arrows, trying to protect this place. And the Babylonian army has besieged it, and they're around the outside, and they're trying to break through. And it actually takes quite a while. There's the entire time of the siege, probably goes more than a year, and they're trying to break through. And what's God doing here? And God does not send in an air raid to bomb the enemy. And God does not send a bombing raid on the city of Babylon. That's what human leaders do. It's not what God does. What God does is to create internal conflict amongst the people who are trying to take over God's world. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower that they were building, and the Lord said, if there's one people all speaking the same language, there's nothing they plan to do that will be impossible for them. They will take the entire world away from God unless God acts. That's what he's saying. So God's decision is to go down and confuse their language so that they will not understand each other. So now, amongst all these humans that are plotting to take over God's world, they're trying to further these plans through communication with each other. And one person says something and the other person goes, huh? No idea what you're talking about. And the other person didn't understand what they said either. Because this confusion of languages means that the combined attempt to take over the whole world of God fails. So God uses this strategy instead of a bombing run to prevent Babylon taking over the world. What I think is incredibly interesting is, as you watch the rise and fall of nations, you will see this at work, the confusion amongst the leaders, the conflict amongst the human leaders that are attempting to work together is ultimately what brings the nations down time and time and time again. I've got any history buffs in the room? You studied the Roman Empire or the ancient Babylon? A couple of history buffs. You know what I'm talking about? It always works like that. Okay, if you don't know history, how about How about Western Australia? We had an election recently. We were supposed to have multiple political parties, but can I name it? The Liberal Party had gone into self-destruct mode. The internal fighting within the Liberal Party, which actually goes back decades now, just completely decimated what was meant to be an alternative government opportunity to the place where most West Australians thought there's no credible alternative and voted Labor and put Labor back into power again. Not because we all think Labor's the best thing that ever happened, but because the other party had destroyed itself. Am I being fair? Like, that's how politics actually works. I could say the same about some of the smaller political parties from Canberra. You'll see it again and again where parties just implode because the attempt to hold power together doesn't work because people are so consumed with the attempt to take power that they end up harming and destroying each other, not understanding each other, not working together, and the whole thing eventually falls in a hole. Now, it could do a lot of damage in the meantime. Like, Babylon does a lot of damage to Israel and to many other nations in Old Testament times. But Jeremiah is one of the ones who's been saying Babylon will come and it will destroy Jerusalem. That's the whole first 30 chapters of Jeremiah are all saying that. But then once Babylon has come and destroyed Jerusalem, Jeremiah starts saying Babylon's going to fall too. So Jeremiah 51 is just this description of the whole place coming tumbling down because God is not going to allow other powers to take over his world. So God doesn't use the same military strategies that the nations use, but God is not going to allow the empires and the kingdoms and the rulers of this world to band together and to take the earth from him. That, I think, is the message of this chapter and the hope that this would have given to Israel even after Babylon did take Israel and Judah in 586, 587 BC. Is that okay? The Lord scattered them from there all over the earth and they stopped building the city. Scattered, not with bombs, but with a confusion of languages so they couldn't understand each other and combine against God. Because the Lord confused the language of the whole world and from there the Lord scattered them over the face of the earth. Okay, so next time you hear about the Tower of Babel, will you think of the city of Babylon attempting to build a symbol that says we've taken the power of the gods into human hands? Makes sense of the chapter, I think. Shall we move on? I mentioned to you earlier that there's a very clear marker of where the stories stop and start in the Hebrew text. The key word is toledot. Remember that one? Toledot means a family story, a family line, family descendancy. This is Shem's toledot. The account of Shem's family line. Who was Shem? One of Noah's sons. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem is the one that leads to Abraham. So this is the account of Shem's family line. Now, rather than read all of them in your notes on page 67, there's just a list of the names. And it leads from Shem through Arphaxad, Shelah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, and Terah. Terah is the father of someone named Abram. And of course, Abram becomes Abraham. So sometimes tonight, I'll be using Abram because that's his name at this stage. But other times, I'll just use Abraham's to make sure that we all understand who we're talking about. And Abraham becomes the father of Isaac, the father of Jacob, the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. So Israel is a nation that is born from Abraham, if you trace it back three generations earlier. And that's the whole point of this passage. Isn't it interesting that this section of scripture connects Israel through Shem and Noah with all the other nations? Israel's story occupies the whole of the rest of the Old Testament. But it starts in the framework of God being the Lord over all the nations. And that's crucial. We're going to see this again and again, that God's interest is always the nations, and Israel is the people through whom he will reach the nation. The mission is always the nations and not just Israel. So in a sense, the Lord is the father of the whole human family. That phraseology is not in the text here, but looking back from a Christian perspective, I think that's really, really obvious. The whole human family, all the nations of the earth, belong under God, even though God chose one family through which he would restore his fatherhood to the nations. So we're going to read something of the story of Abraham's father, Terah, starting from verse 27. This is the toledot of Terah, Abraham's father, family line of Terah. Well, that was a short one, wasn't it? We just saw one there that was only about just a few verses ago, about 7 verses ago. It's probably the shortest toledot in the entire book. That's one story, and it's a bridge. It's a bridge between the nations and the Abraham story. Chapter 11, verse 26 then starts a new toledot. This is the beginning of a new section, and it's the story of the father of Abram, and Abram's story then runs all the way to the middle of chapter 25. So it's 14 chapters. So we had a little brief toledot, 7 verses as a complete section. Now we've got 14 chapters, the story of Abraham, before we get to the other family stories that follow. Okay, shall we have a quick look at the beginning of Abram's story? This is the toledot of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So there's 3 sons here. Haran became the father of Lot. Lot then is Abram's nephew, his brother's son. Haran died in Ur of the Chaldees, so they're still living in Ur at this time. By the way, I don't know if you saw the picture that we had in your notes there. There was a picture of that. This is what is called a ziggurat, and this was the ziggurat at Ur, which is still there. If you go there today, like those little tiny people standing on top of it, you can climb up onto the bricks because it's made from baked bricks and not from stone. This isn't the only one. There were other places that had ziggurats as well. Now, Old Testament times, it would have been much, much, much taller than what it is in the picture here because it's been eroded over time, but it's still actually there. So when it talks about a city with this tower that's reaching up to grab the power of the gods, some of that is probably still present in the region. Isn't that fascinating?
It says a lot of the quality of architecture also at that time.
Astounding architecture.
The understanding of how structures work.
We're talking at more than 4,000 years old, and they're realising the whole technology of how to make the thing, but there's a lot of effort, a lot of thought, a lot of work, a lot of experience, a lot of failures that have gone before as they learn how to build this enormously tall structure from baked bricks.
Would that have been the tower, or would that have been the city?
That's the tower. The people didn't live in that. When archaeologists wonder what it was used for, they suggest that it probably was used as worship, maybe the moon god or something, okay. But it wasn't where people lived around.
And you could go, there was something the inside, it was like rooms.
Basically, you climbed up to try to get close to the heavens. So it's fascinating that these sorts of things are still there and would have been there at the time when the story was being written. So the people who are writing it, I imagine, had these things in mind as they told the story. Okay, so that came out of the fact that one of them died before they left Ur. Ur is in what later became Babylon, what was Chaldea back in that time, ruled by the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor both married, and the name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and later that gets changed to Sarah, which means princess. And the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. She was the daughter of Haran, the father of both Milcah and Isha. So there were people who were kind of like marrying within the family. It was considered to be you married within your own tribe. That was kind of normal back in those times. However, verse 30, Sarai was childless because she was not able to conceive. So she couldn't have children. Now, I know some people today who'd be fine with not having kids. We live in a world where lots of people don't have kids. But back in this early world, that was actually considered very shameful for a woman. So Sarah would have been suffering a lot of shame that she was unable to have children. And it's stated twice there, isn't it? Because we really need to get this point. Sarah is childless because she was unable to conceive. Now, bear that in mind, because you might wonder why on earth God would try to make a nation out of someone who could not conceive. Does that actually compute? Can we make any sense of that? We'll need to keep that question in mind, I think, as we go into the next chapter. So Terah took his son Abraham and his grandson Lot and his son Haran and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Abram, and together they set out from Ur of the Chaldees to go to Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there, and Terah lived 205 years in total, and then he died in Haran. We've probably got a map of that somewhere. There it is. So they're coming from Ur, which is over on the bottom right-hand side of the map, and they're wanting to go to Canaan, which is on the Mediterranean, on the left-hand side of the map. But they don't go straight across here because this is Arabian desert. So they travel up through this region between the two rivers, the Tigris River and the Euphrates River. And this region between the two rivers is called Mesopotamia. So they travel up the Fertile Crescent between the two rivers because that's where the roads are, that's where the water is, that's the easy way to go. And so this region around the desert was referred to as a Fertile Crescent. So you may hear those sorts of words if you're reading some of the books or listening to people talking about that. So they follow the Fertile Crescent to go from Ur to get to Canaan, but they only get as far as Haran up in the north, which is in the very northern region of Syria today, not far from the Turkish border. And then they settle there. And dear old Terah's getting older, and I guess he's probably not finding it easy to travel anymore. So the whole family settles in that spot before Terah dies and Abram continues the journey southward towards Canaan. And then the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your people and your father's household to the land that I will show you.
Isn't it interesting that Terah lived for 205 years, but in Genesis 6, God says that his days shall be 120 years. He talks about reducing the lifespan of humans at that stage.
Yeah, so my spirit will not always contend with humans forever. This is when humans are being disobedient to God and there's no one left to follow God because the wickedness of humanity was so great that every imagination of the human heart was only evil all the time. And God responds to that by saying, my spirit will not contend with humans forever. They are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. Now, there's two ways to understand that, individually or corporately. Was God saying, no individual is going to live for 120 years anymore? Or was God saying, I'm going to give humanity 120 years of probation to see if they turn this around, to see if there's a people who will follow me? So is it 120 years of probation for everyone, or is it about individual lifespans? It could be either.
Alan, do we know why Terah settled in Haran? Because in verse 31, it's clear that the second part of that says, together they set out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to Canaan. But yet Terah and his household chose to settle in Haran.
So yeah, you're right.
And then God then asked Abram to go to the ultimate destination, which is Canaan.
Correct.
So I'm curious as to why Terah effectively settled and stopped God's plan, so to speak.
Why he stopped halfway?
Yeah.
I don't know. In case you've never heard that before. We really don't know why. I mean, you can imagine a thousand different reasons why that might be the case. Maybe there was health issues as he aged and that the rest of the journey was actually not possible for him. And so they waited until, I mean, we honestly don't know. Maybe he got sidetracked. Maybe they were so disillusioned with the Babel builders in Ur that they felt like, let's just get away from there. And once he got away, he was okay. And he forgot where he was actually going. I mean, yeah. Could be a thousand reasons.
What's interesting, of course, is that God hadn't forgotten because he asked Abraham to continue on that journey.
Yes. So when God says, go to the place I will show you, it's interesting that at least in the way the story is told here, they had some idea previously. His father knew where they were actually headed and then got waylaid along the way. I don't know anyone else who has ever got waylaid along the way with where God's taking you. That's never happened since, has it? Not uncommon. So whatever his reason, he stopped. And then because he's ahead of the family, then Abram has to stop with his father. But once the father has died, Abram has to continue the journey that God has called him to. That's all we know for sure. That's great. Good questions. Good discussion. Anything else on chapter 11?
What do you think Abram's relationship with the Lord was? It's really a bit later on he starts to address God, sovereign Lord. Did he recognise that at the stage?
Yeah. Again, we're not told a lot about that. We're not told exactly what Terah's relationship with the Lord actually was. But Abram certainly has this relationship with the Lord God that becomes clear in chapter 12. The Lord said to Abram, is the start of chapter 12. And Abram responds. And everywhere he goes, he sets up altars to recognize the Lord. So yeah, very clearly, the Lord is the God of Abram. And Abram lives for this God and not for the powers in Babylon that he's left behind. He has this relationship with the one God who is Lord of all peoples. At what point that started, whether his father had that, again, we really don't know the answers to all of that. But clearly through Abram's whole life, his relationship is with the one God he recognises.
Have you been to the Babylon area yourself?
I haven't. I've flown over it. On the way to Israel the first time in 2014, we were flying over there with an American Bible College professor. But we flew directly from Australia. And we were, was it Qatar Airlines? I think we were on Qatar. And as we're flying over, I'm looking out the window, trying to figure out where we might be, and look down, and there in the middle of what looked like a relatively dry land was a river and a large body of water, like a huge lake. And I'm thinking, where we're flying, there's only two possibilities. It has to be either the Tigris or the Euphrates. So we flew over at Tigris, and we saw that region. Now, we weren't down the level where we could see the ruins of old Babylon, but from the air, you could clearly see the layout of these two rivers and this body of water, which we tracked down later to be Mosul Dam. So Mosul Dam, if you look on the map of Iraq today, it's in the northern region, and it's one of the larger bodies of water. And from the shape of it, the photograph that we took, was able to identify that we were actually flying over Mosul, so we knew where we were. And that's the closest I've been. Iraq is a troubled area today. And in the recent wars, much of the stuff, even from ancient Babylon, from 2,500 years ago, has actually been bombed and harmed. And, you know, it's just a loss of history that can never be gained back again. This place has a history that goes back so far. And I would love to go there, except now's probably not the right time.
Do you think that verse 8, where it says that the Lord scattered them all over the earth, that's, and with the different languages, that's the start of the flood, that people dispersed across the earth then, and with different languages obviously?
So there was a dispersing that happened when people couldn't understand each other. I'm going to assume that God did not break language groups within a family. The family was actually able to still understand each other, but between the clans or between the families or between the nations, then people had different languages that stopped them from communicating well with each other. And I'm going to assume that the families that shared a language would tend to congregate together, and the people who didn't share a language would tend to spread out and scatter even further. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, hence we have so many diverse languages.
It seems to be the case. And I'm sure there are language groups that were in other places that Israel didn't know about. But within this region, this is the story of how God caused people to spread out over the earth. Right back in the beginning, God said, be fruitful and multiply, go fill the earth, right? And they said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to have a centralized government and control everybody. And God said, no, you're not. By confusing the languages, they ended up spreading out in the way that God had always intended. Is this how you've understood Genesis 11 before? What's often called the Tower of Babel? It's more than a tower. It's a city. It's the story of why there's a kingdom that will harm the people of God centuries ahead of Abraham's time.
I think Babylon is beyond the representation of a city. It's a system of rebellion against God.
Yes.
Even today, in whatever form it is that is rebellious against God.
So Babylon represents a system of resistance against God, is effectively what we're talking about there. Yeah, it does. It becomes a symbol of the rebellion against God's authority and the attempt to take over and control nations and peoples and ultimately the world. So when Babylon itself falls in Old Testament times, it was about 539, if I remember correctly, the Persians came in and conquered Babylon. And so Babylon has fallen, but it's still a symbol after that time. So even when we get to the final book of the Bible, we read about Babylon the Great. It's that symbol for every empire, every power, every superpower that wants to take over the world. It's not just a little place in Iraq. It's become a global symbol for that rebellion against God, for any human power that wants to rule the world. So if it's any superpower, there have been many superpowers since then. And in the time of the New Testament, when Revelation was written, Rome was the Babylon of their day. In later times, there have been many more Babylons. The British Empire tried to take over the whole world. So it was a Babylon, because any superpower that tries to run the world is a Babylon. Who are the superpowers today? If I were to name the two biggest superpowers on the earth today, are they Babylons? The craving for power is at the heart of what's evil, because power belongs in God's hands. And if that's true, then the gospel calls us to submission to Jesus as the only king of all kings, the only ruler of the entire world. And giving our allegiance to him is the thing that ultimately liberates us from every power that wants to take over the world. Try to tread carefully with the politics of the time that we live in, but we call them superpowers and they call them kingdoms and empires. But we still need to recognize that every human power that wants to take over is trying to grasp the power of... It's the same thing that happened in the garden in the beginning. People trying to take the power that belongs in God's hands and effectively to try to be gods, you know, and right, take the power of the gods. And yeah, that's the nature of evil. Can I also point out that right at the end of the book of Revelation, Babylon does fall, and one of the cities that has fallen previously comes back. There is a new Jerusalem, isn't there? In Old Testament times, Jerusalem was the city that recognized God's authority. Jerusalem did not exist for the sake of the name of man. It existed for the sake of the name of God, the great sovereign over all the earth, according to Psalm 48, I think it is. So Jerusalem is the place that represents God's reign, whereas Babylon is the symbol for human power in place of God's power. And at the end of the whole Bible story, the Babylon powers fall and the new Jerusalem returns. So we're in the middle of something like an incredible sports event. And at halftime, Jerusalem looks like it's gone down and Babylon looks like it's won. But at the end, Babylon falls and Jerusalem does a comeback under the leadership of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That's how the whole Bible narrative plays out. And Genesis lays the foundation for all of that. I think we should have a coffee break. So we'll stop for a bit and we'll come back about 8:05 to do chapter 12.